Chapter 15. Tanzania. The Njiwa's negligible head start quickly became insurmountable as Sam and Remy came up against the Tanzanian geography. Where road travel along the coast and in between population centers was fairly easy, they realized navigating off the beaten path would be a nightmare. The only passable road heading south from Dar es Salaam was the B2, which ran the length of southern Tanzania, never straying closer than 10 miles from the coast until it reached Somanga village, 90 miles south of Sikuti Island. After realizing they would neither reach their destination by road nor before the Njiwa, they mentally regrouped. Now aware Rivera had some powerful friends on his side, they decided to err on the side of slight paranoia. If Rivera was playing the worst-case scenario game, he might assume they'd taken up pursuit from Zanzibar or Dar es Salaam, and having come to the same conclusion about road travel as they had, he would expect them to arrive by boat. By nightfall, after half a dozen fruitless phone calls, they found a bush pilot who agreed to take them from the Ras Kutani airstrip outside Dar es Salaam to Mafia Island's airstrip the next morning. From there, it would be a half-day's boat ride north to Sikuti Island, a detail they left in Selma's expert logistical hands. Such was Africa, the Fargos knew. Though they'd heard the term African Mile before, this was the first time they'd experienced it firsthand. What elsewhere would have been a 30-mile jaunt down the coast had turned into a convoluted 150-mile journey. With a night to kill, Sam kept his promise and booked them into the presidential suite at the Mavenpick Royal Palm overlooking the ocean. Following an afternoon in the hotel's spa, they shared a late dinner in L'Olivetto, the hotel's Italian restaurant. "It feels like we've been away from civilization for months," Remy said across the table. "You don't look it," Sam replied. Ever resourceful, Remy had found a simple but elegant Zac Posen little black dress in the hotel's boutique. "Thank you, Sam." The waiter arrived, and Sam gave him their wine selection. Sam said to Remy, "I saw you were reading Blaylock's biography at the spa. Any revelations?" "It's slow going. It wasn't written by Blaylock, I can tell you that much. Unless his grasp of English was tenuous at best. I'm guessing Morton penned it. But from what source?" "One thing that struck me, there's no mention of Blaylock before he arrived in Africa. It begins the day he set foot in Bagamoyo. No personal details about his life up to that point." "Interesting. How's the index?" Remy shrugged. "What you'd expect. I'm sure Selma, Pete, and Wendy will have more luck with it. I did check for any mention of the Belle or the Ophelia. There was nothing." "Odd. If he's the one that took the time to inscribe all the hieroglyphics on the Belle, you'd think it would at least warrant a mention. Sounds like a man trying to hide a secret." "A big secret," Remy added. "So big, the Mexican government may have been murdering people over it for the last 7 years. The airport shuttle dropped them off at the Ras Kutani shortly after dawn. Aside from a few maintenance people moving about in the morning fog, the airstrip was quiet and devoid of life. As the shuttle pulled away, a figure emerged from the mist and approached them. He wore safari khakis, calf-high jungle boots, and a baseball cap emblazoned with the U.S. Army Rangers insignia. He had close-cropped black hair and a thick mustache. "Ed Mitchell," he said without preamble. "Sam and Remy Fargo," Sam replied. "You're American?"
"More or less. Expatriate, I guess you'd call it."
"That all you got?" he said, nodding to Sam and Remy's backpacks. They'd left the majority of their baggage with Vutolo, an old friend and the concierge at the Mavenpick.
"This is it," Sam replied.
"Okay. I'm ready if you are." Mitchell turned and started walking. Sam and Remy followed him to a sturdy-looking but weathered Bush Air Cessna 182. Mitchell loaded their gear aboard, got them buckled into the back seat, and did a rote pre-flight check. Within 5 minutes of arriving, they were airborne and headed south.
"Diving," Mitchell's voice said over their headsets.
Pardon? Remy replied.
That's why you're going to Mafia, I assume.
Oh, right.
Sam said, Mr. Mitchell, how long have you been in Africa?
Name's Ed. 22 years, I guess. Came here with Rand to do a radar installation back in 88. Fell in love with it and decided to stay. I flew Spads and Hueys in Nam, so bush flying seemed like a good fit. Set up shop and the rest is history.
Sounds familiar, Remy replied.
Which part?
Falling in love with Africa.
It has the tendency to get into your blood. Every few years I go back to the States to see friends, but I always end up coming back early.
For the first time, Mitchell chuckled.
I guess that'd make me an Africa junkie. What do you know about Sakuti Island? Sam asked.
Great diving.
Prickly owner. A guy named Ambonisie Okafor.
You thinking about going there?
Thinking about it.
We can fly over.
He owns the island, not the airspace. It'd only cost us 15 minutes or so.
Mitchell made the course adjustment, and within a few minutes the island came into view out the left-hand window.
Sakuti is actually part of the Mafia archipelago, and depending on who you ask, they're part of the spice chain along with Zanzibar, Mitchell said. Big and little Sakuti. The big one situated to the north, the little one to the south. See the little waterway between them? Since it's only 50 or 60 feet wide, they're officially considered a single landmass. All in all, about 5 square miles. See the other one there, 4 miles to the south? That's North Fanjove.
And the long one sitting between them? Remy asked.
That's more atoll than island. A reef and sandbar. Doesn't really have a name that I know of. It's just so close to the surface that it looks solid. You can walk across it, but you'd be wading up to your knees.
Are those craters? Sam asked, peering out the window.
Yep. Back before World War I, German battleships and cruisers used to use Sakuti and Fanjove for target practice. In some places, they punched holes straight down the water table. That's why Fanjove is so popular with cave divers. They rope down into the craters and explore. Every year, 3 or 4 die doing it.
Are you?
No, Sam replied. Just regular diving. Watch yourself. Okafor claims 2 miles all around Sakuti. He's got patrol boats and a few armed guards. He even tries to warn people away from Fanjove, but he's got no legal claim there. There's his house. There on the peak.
Sam and Remy craned their necks to take a look. Ambonisie Okafor's island vacation home was a 4-story Italian-style villa surrounded by a chest-high stone wall. Neatly groomed, crushed shell paths branched out from the estate like crooked wheel spokes. If set 65 years earlier and dropped into the Pacific Ocean, Big Sakuti could have easily passed for a Japanese fortress island during World War II. Shaped like a cone whose rear quarter had been cleaved down to the waterline, the island's southern, lower reaches were devoid of plant life, save the occasional scrub brush, and completely without cover save the occasional boulder. A half mile from the shore, the moonscape gave way to a swath patch of rainforest that ended where the estate's grounds began.
Replace that villa with a bunker complex and you've got a smaller version of Iwo Jima, Sam said. Keeping that jungle at bay probably requires a full-time maintenance staff. 2 of the island's paths caught their attention. One led to a dock on the island's northwestern side. The Njiwa was tied up alongside the pier. Opposite her were 2 Rinker speedboats like those Rivera and his men had used during the theft of the Bell. They could see several figures moving along the Njiwa's deck, but at this altitude couldn't make out any faces. The other significant path led to a clearing bordered by white-painted stones. In the center, more stones, these embedded in the earth, formed a giant H. A helicopter landing pad.
Remy said, Ed, is that a...
Yep, he owns a Eurocopter EC-135. Top-of-the-line bird. Okafor doesn't drive anywhere if he can help it. A status thing, I suspect. Either of you fly.
I've got my single engine, Sam replied. I've taken helicopter lessons. I have 10 hours in the cockpit. It's a tougher adjustment than I'd imagined.
Boy, you got that right.
I don't see many guards or fences down there, Remy said. Odd for a man who enjoys his privacy.
He's got enough of a reputation that he doesn't need as much protection now. He prosecutes trespassers without mercy. Rumor has it a few of them have even disappeared after pushing their luck.
You believe that? Sam asked.
I tend to. Okafor was a general in the Tanzanian army before he retired. Tough, scary guy. Seen enough?
Yes, Sam replied.
The remainder of the flight was quiet, punctuated only by Ed's occasional utterances over their headsets as he pointed out landmarks and offered bits of African history. Just before 7:30, they touched down on Mafia Island's gravel airstrip and taxied up to the terminal, a whitewashed building with dusky blue trim and a brick-red tin roof. Beside the building, a pair of uniformed immigration officials sat in the shade of a baobab. As the engines wound down, Ed climbed out and retrieved their backpacks from the cargo compartment. He handed them his card, said, "Safe travels, Fargos. Call me if you run into trouble," then gave them a smile they could only describe as conspiratorial. Sam smiled back.
"You know something we don't?"
"No. But I know adventure hounds when I see them.
I'd say you two can handle yourselves better than most, but Africa is an unforgiving place. The number on my card is my satellite phone. I'll leave it on."
"Thanks, Ed." They shook hands. Then Ed turned and headed toward a Quonset hut whose window displayed a flickering red neon beer sign. They grabbed their backpacks and headed toward the terminal, but were intercepted on the sidewalk by the two officials from under the baobab. After a cursory glance at their passports, the officials poked through their belongings, then stamped the passports and offered a "Welcome to Mafia Island" in halting English.
"You need taxi?" one of the officials asked. Without waiting for a response, he raised his hand and whistled.
From the turnaround outside the airport entrance, a rust-riddled gray Peugeot growled to life. Sam said, "Thank you, but no. We'll find our own transportation." Hand still raised, the official looked quizzically at Sam.
"Huh?"
Sam pointed to the Peugeot and shook his head. "La Asante. No thanks." The official shrugged, then waved off the taxi driver and said,
"Sawa."
"Okay." He and his partner walked back to the baobab.
"What was that all about?" Remy asked.
"They were in cahoots. At best, we get a padded fare. At worst, we get taken to a private alley and robbed."
Remy smiled. "Sam Fargo, where's your trust in humanity?"
"Right now, it's the same place as my wallet. Well hidden."
While Mafia Island was a popular destination for extreme scuba divers, it was also a hub for the Tanzanian black market. Sam explained this to Remy.
She said, "You're a font of trivia. Where did you come across this tidbit?"
"I downloaded the CIA World Factbook to my iPhone. Very handy. Come on, we'll walk. It's not far."
"What's to stop us from getting mugged on the street?"
Sam lifted the tail of his shirt to expose the butt of the H&K. Remy smiled and shook her head.
"Just go easy, Tex. No OK Corral reenactments, please."
According to their maps, the Mafia Island airstrip bisected the island's largest town, Kilindoni, into north and south portions, the former situated more inland, the latter hugging the coast. That was where, Selma had told them, they would find the docks and the boat she'd rented for them. Despite it being not yet 8 a.m, the sun shone brightly in a clear blue sky, and within minutes of leaving the airstrip, both Sam and Remy were sweating. They felt eyes watching their every step, many of which belonged to curious children who paralleled their path, waving and smiling shyly at the white strangers who'd come to their village. After 20 minutes of walking down hard-packed dirt roads lined with ramshackle huts that ranged in composition from tin to brick to cardboard, they arrived at the beach. Equally dilapidated boat sheds and warehouses lined the dunes overlooking the water. A dozen wood plank docks jutted into the surf. 30 to 40 boats, from decades-old motor cruisers to skiffs to dhows, both sail-driven and motorized, bobbed at anchor in the harbor. Near the waterline, clusters of men and boys worked, repairing nets, scraping hulls, or cleaning fish.
"I miss the Andreal," Remy murmured.
"Well, now that it's got a grenade hole in the center of the afterdeck, we own it," Sam replied. "Maybe we'll pull it off the bottom. We'll call it a souvenir." He turned and scanned the row of buildings along the dune. "We're looking for a bar called the Red Bird."
"There," Remy said, pointing 50 yards down the beach to a thatch longhouse fronted by a black-painted 4x8-foot plywood sign sporting a crow painted in bright red.
They walked that way. As they approached the wooden steps, a quartet of men stopped their animated conversation and looked at them. Sam said, "Morning. We're looking for Bouziba." For a long 10 seconds, none of them spoke.
"Una zungumza ki ingereza?" Remy asked. "Do you speak English?"
No response. For the next 2 minutes, Sam and Remy used their limited knowledge of Swahili to try to start a dialogue, but to no avail. A voice behind them said, "Bouziba, don't be a jackass." They turned to see a grinning Ed Mitchell standing behind them. He had a Tusker beer in each hand.
"Are you following us?" Sam asked.
"More or less.
We're probably the only 3 Americans on the island right now. Thought a little solidarity couldn't hurt."
"I know old Bouziba here," Ed said, nodding to the gray-haired man sitting on the top step.
"He speaks English. Playing dumb is his bargaining strategy." Ed barked out a sentence in Swahili, and the other 3 men got up and wandered back inside the bar.
"Now be a gentleman, Bouziba," Ed said. "These are friends."
The old man's dour expression dropped away. He smiled broadly.
"Friends of Mr. Ed are friends of me."
"I told you not to call me that," Mitchell said, then to Sam and Remy. "He saw reruns of the TV show. He gets a laugh out of comparing me to a talking horse."
Remy said to Bouziba, "Your English is very good."
"Fair indeed, yes. Better than your Swahili, eh?"
"Without a doubt," Sam replied. "A friend of ours called you about a boat."
Bouziba nodded.
"Miss Selma, yesterday. I have your boat. $400.
"Per day?"
"Huh?"
Ed said something in Swahili, and Bouziba responded. Ed said,
$400 to sell. He gave up fishing last year. Been trying to sell the thing ever since. The bar brings in plenty of money for him."
Sam and Remy exchanged glances. Ed added,
"You'd probably pay that for 2 days' rental from anyone else here."
"Let's see it," Sam said. The 4 of them walked down the beach to where an 18-foot aquamarine blue dhow sat atop a half-dozen V-shaped sawhorses. A pair of young boys were sitting in the sand beside the dhow's hull. One was scraping while the other was painting. Bouziba said,
"Look, inspect."
Sam and Remy walked around the dhow, checking for signs of decay and disrepair. Sam poked the seams with his Swiss Army knife while Remy tapped the wood, sounding for rot. Sam walked to the stern, climbed up the ladder leaning against the transom, and stepped onto the afterdeck. He reappeared 2 minutes later and called down, "The sails have got some rot."
"Huh?"
Bouziba replied. Ed translated, listened to Bouziba's response, then said, "He'll throw in a new set for $50. Remy asked Sam,
"How's the cabin?"
"Cozy in the extreme. Not the Maven pick, but we've seen worse."
"And the engine?"
"Old, but well-maintained. Should give us 6 or 7 knots." Remy walked to the transom and inspected the propeller and shaft.
"I'm betting the bearings could use repacking."
Ed translated, listened, then replied, "He says another 50 and he'll have it done in 2 hours." 25, Sam countered. "He gives me the supplies and the tools and I'll do it myself." Buziba jutted out his lower lip and stuck his chin in the air, thinking.
50. I add portable water and food for 2 days.
3 days, Remy replied. Buziba considered this, then shrugged.
3 days.